All right, so we are making our way through the book of Revelation, and we're up to chapter 17. So I guess just by way of revision, that we recognize that there's four main views on the book of Revelation, and they all, I guess, have their reasons for believing what they believe, and that's all okay. The issues are what we'd call disputable matters. The things that don't impact on our salvation or who Jesus is and so on. It's more to do with his plan on the earth and so on. And so can anyone remember the four views? Bit of a test. The preterist view, which is the one that I'm presenting, and that's the view that the stuff in the book of Revelation, most of it, not all of it, but the majority of it is has already happened in the past, and it's to do with the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in order to establish the new covenant more fully, because while the temple was still in operation, it was a stumbling block in the road of Christianity and in the way of the new covenant. And in order to fully establish the new covenant and have Christ as the temple, the old covenant needed to be closed off, and that included the removal of the temple in Jerusalem. In order to finish up the old covenant also, the curses of the covenant, needed to be meted out for the unfaithfulness of apostate Israel in terms of the old covenant. And so we see a lot of links between the establishment of the old covenant and the fulfillment of the old covenant during the time of the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. But we do see God's grace at work in that. So we've had the seven letters to the seven churches, which is really a presentation of the gospel. And then we have the opening of the seven seals, which is, is a double-sided thing, and the scroll was double-sided after all. But part of it is sort of the establishment of the new covenant, but also as a divorce of Israel, old covenant Israel, as was promised by the prophets throughout the old covenant. We then had the seven trumpets, which sounded a warning and kind of covered the period from about AD 68 to AD 60, or early AD 70 during the Jewish Wars, and then the seven bowls, which were poured out in AD 70, which talk about the destruction of the city. That's the preterist view on where we've got up to, sorry. So that's one of the others. Anyone remember what? The futurists, yeah. So the futurists look at the book of Revelation and they believe that pretty much all of the book of Revelation is yet to happen. And so it's to do with the last few years before the return of Christ and the things that are going to happen there. So we sort of discussed that a little bit early on. I guess if I was to look at all of the views throughout the whole book, we'd be on it for about 5 or 6 years, I suppose. I don't know. Maybe we'd never get done. I'm just presenting one view. But the futurist view is a view. It's a perspective, and we'll probably talk a little bit more about its development over the next, particularly once we get to chapters 19 and 20. There's two other perspectives. There's anyone got another one? Historicists, yeah. So the historicists look at the book of Revelation and they see it as a record of events from the time that the church was established and goes through to the time when Christ returns. Often with the historicist view, a lot of the images of the beast and so on is looking at the Roman Empire up to about 500 AD, and then sort of looking at the Reformation in particular and the role of the Catholic Church in the Reformation and all that sort of stuff leading through. So that's the historicist view. So they would say we're still in the book of Revelation. And then the last one is the idealist view, which says that the book of Revelation is not about anything in history, it's just about the concepts of God and the way that he works in history, that there's always a beast, there's always a sea beast, there's always a land beast, there's always a dragon, and the church is always struggling against them, and you know, God overcomes throughout history. And as I said, there's elements to each of those views that you would say, well, yeah, I can see how you would arrive at that and how you'd think that. As I said, personally, I've come to the preterist perspective, but quite happy to continue the conversation. As one commentator who was a preterist said, I don't believe that there's going to be a rapture as such, but I'm happy to change my mind mid-air. So, that's all good. So we sit in the saddle loosely, and it's one of those points that the actual discussion is a good thing, because it helps us to understand the word better and, I guess examine our perspective and be willing to sort of, have a look at other ways of thinking about things. So that's where we're at. All right, so we're in chapter 17, and as I said, from the preterist perspective, it's all about the destruction of Jerusalem in order to establish the new covenant. And we've just finished chapter 16, where the city's been destroyed in the pouring out of the seven bowls. And now we come to a place where we get another look at the same event, but from a slightly different perspective, which is what's been happening throughout the book of Revelation anyway. You sort of have these events happen, and then there's a step back and look at a vision that kind of describes things from a different perspective. So, Revelation 17 and verse 1 says, "Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, 'Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers on earth have become drunk.'" So as I said, we've just looked at the seven bowls, and one of the angels who was pouring out the seven bowls comes and talks to John. So that shows that this vision is linked to what happened previously. So the vision is of the great prostitute, there's a bit of a contrast going on here between the New Jerusalem, which is the church, and the Old Jerusalem. So we've got two, as it were, in the vision. Back in chapter 12, there was a vision of, I think it was chapter 12, there was a vision of a woman, and she was sort of, clothed in the sun and the moon at her feet, and the one, which was a representation of the true church. But we've got this contrast that's coming in between these two women, the unfaithful bride and the faithful bride, so the church and apostate Israel. And in Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 21, it says, "How the faithful city has become a whore. She who was full of justice, righteous, lodged in her, but now murderers." So we've got this contrast between what Israel should have been and what Israel became. The language around sexual immorality is to do with covenant unfaithfulness. So, because the picture is that God chose Israel to be his bride, but Israel wasn't a faithful bride. Israel turned to the nations around to seek guidance and direction and protection and all that, and riches and all those sorts of things, and didn't rely fully on God as her source of provision and direction and safety and security and all those sorts of things. So that's the picture, is that Israel is the unfaithful bride, whereas the church is established as the faithful bride because Christ has come as the Messiah and he's established his new covenant, and part of the new covenant is the Holy Spirit comes and dwells in us and enables us to be faithful because of his faithfulness. Okay, so that's the main distinction. And so I've lost the reference there, but there's another passage that says, "Rejoice not, O Israel, exult not like the peoples, for you have played the whore, forsaking your God. You have loved a prostitute's wages on all the threshing floors." And the interesting thing about that is that the threshing floor is not an insignificant reference for Israel, because the temple was built on the threshing floor, which is, that was sort of where it was established, because, you know, David bought the threshing floor off of, what's his name, to establish the temple. I've forgotten his name. Anyway, you can look it up. But also the threshing floor was the place where Ruth and Boaz were united. And so, but also the threshing floor is the place where the wheat and the chaff is separated. Okay, so the distinction between faithfulness and unfaithfulness. And so there's all these pictures throughout the Old Covenant sort of building towards this final picture. So, but really, what we're looking at is the fact that Jerusalem had forsaken her husband, who had called her to be Lady Wisdom in the Proverbs, but she had become Madam Folly, who's also in Proverbs. And so we've got these pictures being built throughout the Old Covenant. And the role was, Israel was meant to be a light to the nations, to show them how to live under God's rule, but instead Israel pursued the nations and tried to live like them. And just one example of that is that when the Israelites went to Samuel and said, you know, we want a king because we want to be like the other nations around us. And God said, no, you don't want a king, I'm your king. And they said, no, we want a king. And so there's that rejection of God's rule and God's direction that happened throughout Israel's history. One of the commentators, David Chilton, says, at the very moment when the promised bridegroom arrived, Israel was fornicating with Caesar. The sight of her true husband, Jesus, only drove her further into adulterous union with the kings of the earth. Rejecting Christ's kingship, the chief priest cried, "We have no king but Caesar." And so that's a pretty significant event in Israel's history. And the fact that the picture of the woman here is that she sits on many waters is meant to evoke a number of images, and we have some clarification coming later on in the chapter, but there's some other things going on. So first of all, the voice of God and of Christ and of the faithful church has already been represented throughout the book of Revelation as sounding like many waters. And so unfaithful Israel is sitting in the place where God has been speaking to them and to the earth. We also see that she was given a place of honour, as I said, sitting in the very presence of God, yet became desperately unfaithful to him. And the city of Babylon, just historically, was described by Jeremiah as being on many waters. In Jeremiah 51:13, it says, "O you who dwell by many waters, rich in treasures, your end has come, the thread of your life is cut." And so for those who knew their Old Testament really well, they were reading this and making the connections with, oh, okay, this is actually talking about all these other things as well. So Jerusalem has become Babylon, the persecutor of the people of God, and using her blessings to cause the dwellers of the land, that is the land of Israel, to become drunk with the sexual immorality of political alliances to prop up her security instead of leaning on her husband and maker God. Now, there's a significant lesson in that, just going to the idealist perspective. There's a significant lesson in that for the church, because the true church will always remain faithful, okay? Because that's the true church, and the Holy Spirit is preparing the bride for the bridegroom, you know. That's there's always the temptation for the church to be like Israel and try and seek political security and economic security by trying to do things the way that the nations around do things. Okay, so we want to operate in a way that the world will be pleased with what we do, and so that people will come and the church will be bigger and have more influence on the earth, which is what Israel was doing and why Israel was called an unfaithful woman. The church today is at risk when it believes that salvation will come through political means. So it always, I guess it's a concern for me as a pastor, if we start to believe, or as a Christian, put it that way, if we start to believe that the salvation of our nation will come through a Christian political movement, okay? Because essentially what we're doing is we're climbing on the back of the beast and riding it to try and win victory. That salvation for our nation will only come through Christ. He's our only hope. The Australian political system is never going to save us, and we need to understand that. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't get involved in standing up for righteousness and, you know, lobbying in areas that are appropriate. You know, we should be speaking out against abortion. We should be speaking out against blurring the lines of sexuality. We should be speaking out against a whole range of things. We need to stand for righteousness as the church, and we need to speak out for righteousness, but understanding that that's not going to be the hope for the world. You know, that's not going to save the nation. What's going to save the nation is that people's hearts are going to be turned to Christ and they're going to live in obedience to him. That's quite a salient element that comes out of the book of Revelation there. You found the threshing floor guy. What was his name?
Yeah, Aruna the Jebusite.
There you go, Aruna the Jebusite. Okay.
Nice.
My little research team down here. Appreciate that. All right, let's go to verse 3, Revelation 17. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had 7 heads and 10 horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple scarlet and adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her sexual immorality. And on her forehead was written a name of mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. So where we see the woman in chapter 12, the church, and she had to flee into the wilderness. And now we see the unfaithful woman, and she lives in the wilderness. So there's a distinction already that the church doesn't dwell in the wilderness, but sometimes it's had to flee into the wilderness to escape persecution. But this woman, she dwells in the barren lands. There's no life in what she does. And so that's why the vision occurs in the wilderness. And she rides on a combination of the beasts and dragons that we've seen before. So the dragon and the sea beast of chapters 12 and 13 are kind of combined as the beast that she's sitting on. And it indicates Jerusalem's alliance with Satan and with the Roman Empire, depending on them for her national existence and power. In other words, she was in bed with paganism, cooperating with Rome in the crucifixion of Christ and the persecution of the church. And, of course, Satan was the motivator behind that. And she's also adorned in clothing of the bride. The general picture is that, oh, they're pretty, you know, purple clothes and jewellery and stuff. She's dressed up like a prostitute. And that's one perspective, and that's a valid thing. But when we look in Ezekiel chapter 16 and verse 10, God's talking about Israel, and he says, I clothed you also with embroidered cloth and shod you with fine leather. I wrapped you in fine linen and covered you with silk. And I adorned you with ornaments and put bracelets on your wrists and a chain on your neck. And I put a ring on your nose and earrings in your ears and a beautiful crown on your head. Thus you were adorned with gold and silver, and your clothing was fine linen and silk and embroidered cloth. And in Proverbs chapter 31 and verse 21, it says, she is not afraid, talking about the woman of you know, the faithful wife says she is not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household are clothed in scarlet. She makes bed coverings for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. So the image presents the woman as the one who was called to be the bride, but has taken to herself unfaithfulness and impurities. And instead of communing with her bridegroom through the cup of the Lord's Supper, she takes a cup of impurity, and her dependence is in the pagan state. And by now we're familiar with forehead markings, and on hers is a name of mystery. Interesting, we've come across the concept of mystery before. The mystery is the mystery of the gospel. And so she's meant to sort of reveal the mystery of Christ, and she who sought to seek God's approval through worldly success and observance of the law has become one who finds God's wrath as a result. In other words, she's the abomination, the mother of abominations, and has become drunk on the blood of the saints. And there's that sense in which her existence was part of revealing the gospel, because if Christ wasn't crucified, we wouldn't have the gospel, because he wouldn't have taken our place. And so there is this mystery that's involved here, that is hinted at. But we read in Matthew 23 and 29, Jesus is declaring the seven woes against the Pharisees in Jerusalem. And he says, woe, in verse 29 of chapter 23 of Matthew, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you build the tombs of the prophets and decorate the monuments of the righteous, saying, if we had lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have taken part with them in shedding the blood of the prophets. Thus you witness against yourselves that you are sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of your fathers, you serpents, you brood of vipers. How are you to escape being sentenced to hell? Therefore I send you prophets and wise men and scribes, some of whom you will kill and crucify, and some you will flog in your synagogues and persecute from town to town, so that on you may come all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the sanctuary and the altar. Truly I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. And so this woman is revealed as the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. He's obviously revealing Jerusalem as the woman, because Jerusalem is the city where the prophets die. And Jesus said, in fact, talking to the scribes and Pharisees, that, you know, you would pretend that you wouldn't do what your forefathers did, but you're going to do worse, because obviously they're going to crucify Jesus and persecute the church. And so Jesus said, look, upon this generation, all of these things are going to come and you're going to be punished. Speaking of the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, which those people that Jesus was talking to were those who were in the city at the time of the destruction. All right, verse 6 of Revelation 17. When I saw her, I marveled greatly, but the angel said to me, why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast with the seven heads and 10 horns that carries her. The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. And the dwellers on earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life found from the foundation of the world, will marvel to see the beast, because it was and is not and is to come. This calls for a mind of wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. They are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is, the other has not yet come. And when he does come, he must remain only a little while. All right. So there's a bit going on here. The angel answers John's questions about the woman and the beast, and presents the beast as a parody of the Lord, because the Lord is the one who was and is to come. And now the beast is described as the one who was and is not and is about to rise. So we've got this contrast going on, just like the woman and the unfaithful Israel and the church are being contrasted, so Christ and the beast are being contrasted. Just as the Roman Empire was a major world power in terms of what it was at the time of the Book of Revelation being written, following the death of Nero, the empire was thrown into disarray. In AD 68, Nero died, killed himself, and then the following year was called the Year of the Four Emperors, because there were four emperors in one year, because the empire sort of became chaotic. And so Galba, Otho, and Vitellius, and then finally Vespasian were the four emperors. Now, Vespasian's an interesting character because during the Jewish wars, Vespasian was the general that led the attack against the Jews. And then Nero killed himself and the Roman Empire went into chaos, and Vespasian and his armies were called back to Rome to try and sort out the mess. And, you know, there were the four emperors, but finally Vespasian was actually promoted to become the emperor. So we have the Roman Empire as the empire that was and then was not in the chaos of following Nero's death, and then was about to come, which once things sort of became reorganized under Vespasian, they then came back and Vespasian sent Titus, his son, as the general to march against Jerusalem and sack the city. Interestingly, we were at the... God bless us in being able to travel to Europe a couple of years ago, and we went on a tour of the Colosseum, and outside the Colosseum, probably about 100 metres from the main entrance of the Colosseum, is the Arch of Titus. And the Arch of Titus has a picture of the Roman soldiers carrying away the spoils of the sacking of Jerusalem. And there's a picture of the menorah and other artefacts from the temple being carried away. And Vespasian actually used the funds from the sacking of Jerusalem to build the Colosseum, which then became a place of persecution of the Christians. So there's really fascinating history in that time. So similarly, this new manifestation of the beast, while it's talking about the Roman Empire, previously the beast was identified with Nero, now it's being identified with Vespasian, because he was you know, a general who had a lot of favour with Nero. He fell out of favour with Nero and kind of had to stay out of his way, so he no longer had political influence, but then he was elevated again to a place of, a higher place where he became the emperor of Rome. So the beast represents both the Roman Empire and Vespasian in this instance. All right, how are we doing with that? Bit of history there to, So to further clarify the vision of the seven heads, they're revealed as seven mountains. And of course, Rome is the city on seven hills. So the angel's trying to make it clear to John that I'm talking about Rome here, that the beast is Rome. And he's also made it clear that the woman is Jerusalem, because that's the city that's drunk on the blood of the prophets. And so that's the picture that we've got built. So it says that it had seven kings, five have fallen. And as it happens, Julius Caesar was the first emperor in Rome, followed by Augustus, then Tiberius, and Caligula. And then... as he said, five have been. One is, that's Nero, and one is to come, who'll rule in a little while. Who'll rule only a little while. And Galba, who was the emperor that followed Nero, only ruled for 7 months. And then, during the year of the four emperors, Vespasian eventually became emperor. So, there's kind of a what's happening here is that from a preterist perspective, the prophecy being given in Revelation is a revealing of things that are soon to take place, that the Roman Empire is being positioned to destroy the temple in order that the new covenant can be fully established. And the purpose of the book of Revelation is to show the church that Jesus is at work behind this event that's about to happen, and it's a sign that his... that his resurrection, his ascension into heaven, and the establishment of the church has been completed. Because then there's no longer a stumbling block before the Christians, which is this temple in Jerusalem. How do I worship Jesus? Do I worship in the temple? Do I, you know, how do we do this? And so God removes the temple so that it's no longer a thing. But also, because Christ has come and fulfilled the law and fulfilled the old covenant, the temple in Jerusalem is actually an abomination before God, because the true temple has come. And so there's no longer a need for the old temple, and it needs to be completely removed. And any attempt to try and resurrect the old temple in Jerusalem is blasphemy, because it denies the truth of Christ as the true temple and as the true sacrifice. And that's the purpose of the book of Revelation from the preterist perspective. All right, where are we? Verse 11. It says, as for the beast that was and is not, it is an eighth but belongs to the seven, and it goes to destruction. And the ten horns that you saw are ten kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. These are of one mind, and they hand over their power and authority to the beast, and they will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them, for he is the Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with him are called and chosen and faithful. So the eighth is the number of resurrection. And I guess even though Galba did not reign for very long, the Roman Empire was not dead, but this doesn't mean its victory over the church is going to be fulfilled, because it's on its way to destruction. So there's this sense that, yeah, the Roman Empire is rising up, but it's not going to last forever. It's going to fall. But mixed in with that is, of course, the persecution of the church, which began under Nero. So we've already seen the Roman Empire beginning its persecution. But it's really the Roman Empire is after both the church and the Jews, because they see them as one big problem, because Christianity came out of Judaism. All right. So it says that there are 10 kings who work together with the beast, and Rome had 10 provinces, and the sort of rulers in each province contributed to the attack against Jerusalem, and they also colluded to make war against the Lamb. So persecution against Christians was happening throughout the 10 provinces of Rome during this time. But it says, of course, that the Lamb is going to conquer them. Indeed, after the sacking of Jerusalem, Christian persecution in the Roman Empire continued, but eventually had the victory because, of course, Constantine, the Roman Empire emperor, became a Christian. And so Christ defeated the Romans. Yeah, there you go. I've done bad with getting my references. There's a reference, and I can't remember where it came from. It said, the kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together. Oh, it's in Psalm 2, actually. Yeah, so Psalm 2 says, the kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. And then in verse 10, it goes on to say, but now therefore, O kings, be wise, be warned, O rulers of the earth, serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. So Psalm 2, sort of talking about the Messiah, says, you know, that there's going to be a rising up of the kings of the earth to try and bring the Messiah down, the anointed one of God. But they better submit to him, or else things are not going to go well. Which, of course, we'll get to later on. In fact, it's clear that the goal of Rome in destroying Jerusalem was not only to wipe out the Jews, but the Christians also in one stroke. So there was a historian in around 400 AD called Sulpicius Severus, who records that Tacitus, who was a Roman historian, so he was reading his stuff, and he noted this that came up So this is Tacitus's eyewitness account of the sacking of Jerusalem. He said, Titus is said, after calling a council, to have first deliberated whether he should destroy the temple, a structure of such extraordinary work. For it seemed good to some that a sacred edifice, distinguished above all human achievements, ought not to be destroyed, inasmuch as if preserved, it would furnish an evidence of Roman moderation. But, if destroyed, would serve for a perpetual proof of Roman cruelty. But on the opposite side, others, including Titus himself, thought that the temple ought specially to be overthrown in order that the religion of the Jews and of the Christians might more thoroughly be subverted, for that these religions, although contrary to each other, had nevertheless proceeded from the same authors, that the Christians had sprung up from among the Jews, and that if the root were extirpated, the offshoot would speedily perish. That the Christians had fled the city, Jerusalem, and they didn't depend on the temple for their worship anyway. So Christ was victorious in all of that. Chilton writes, the beast thought that he could kill the whore and the bride in one stroke, but when the dust settled, the scaffolding of the old apostate Jerusalem lay in ruins, and the church was revealed as the new and most glorious temple, God's eternal dwelling place. All right, verse 15, it says, and the angel said to me, the waters that you saw where the prostitute is seated are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. And the 10 horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate and naked and devour her flesh and burn her up with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to carry out this his purpose by being of one mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth. So the Jews had great influence throughout the Roman Empire up until the Jewish Wars. They had, we read in Acts that there were dwelling in Jerusalem Jews, devout men of every nation under heaven. So if there were Jews from every nation, it meant that the Jewish faith had been spread throughout the nations of the earth, and these people were coming to Jerusalem. So they actually had quite a bit of influence. We also read that after the crucifixion of Christ, that Pilate and Herod became good friends. And so the Jews sort of had this elevated position. In fact, there was a law passed that Jews didn't have to swear obedience to Caesar as a god. They had like a get-out-of-jail-free card, as it were, because of the relationship between Rome and the Jews, because of their political kind of position. But of course, eventually, that all blew up and the Jewish Wars occurred. But the Romans actually supported the Jews in the persecution of the Christians. And the Jews leveraged that to try and get rid of the Christians. But of course, after the destruction of Jerusalem and after the Jewish Wars, the Jews were persecuted alongside the Christians, and the Jews could no longer persecute the Christians. And we've talked about that before. So left naked, devoured and burnt with fire, these were all punishments that occurred to unfaithful women during the Old Covenant. So if a woman was found in a community who'd been unfaithful to her husband, one of the punishments was for her to be stripped naked, and here's Jerusalem being left naked as a result of being destroyed. That Jezebel was devoured by dogs, and so Jerusalem is being devoured by the Roman Empire. And a daughter of a priest who was found to be unfaithful was to be burned under the Old Covenant, and so the city was burned, all punishments for convicted adulteresses found in Scripture. And in case we didn't pick up on the earlier clues, the woman is described as the great city which previously the Holy Spirit had used to describe Jerusalem. So we know that, if you haven't picked it up yet, that the woman is Jerusalem. And that all this was put into the hearts of the attacking nations to carry out his purpose in removing the old covenant and fully establishing the new. And it says, and the woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth. Now, you might say, well, how did Jerusalem have dominion over the kings? But we need to understand the perspective of the book of Revelation is not about political power. Okay, it's about the covenant. And in terms of the covenant, Israel was set above the nations because they were God's chosen possession out of the nations to represent him to the nations, and they were to have dominion over the earth to show the nations how to live under God's goodness. But they'd rejected that. And so the nations now have turned on Jerusalem and have come to destroy her. And the church is set in its place as God's prized possession on the earth. And it's now, we're going to come to this in the next few chapters, but it's the role of the church to represent God's wisdom to the earth and to establish his kingdom and his rule on the earth.